Hello. Today on the Loopcast, I'm in conversation with Arash Azizi, the author of The Shadow Commander, Soleimani, the U.S. and Iran's Global Ambitions. This is an excellent book. I think it's for a lot of our audience who focus on Iran, I think this book is pretty good because when I read through it, I was kind of surprised because a lot of how we understand Iranian history, at least in English, is not necessarily told through Iran's rural poor or its soldiers, or in this case, the head of the IRGC. It's always told through clerical eyes. And Arash kind of has introduced this different perspective to not only the revolution, but also Iran's foreign policy and the tensions within Iran's foreign policy between, you know, this idea of exporting the revolution and having a theologically driven foreign policy, the pragmatic demands of foreign policy, and then also this IRGC that is kind of sits between the severely ideological and then also the practical and pragmatic. And it's just a very, it's a great read, and I really suggest it for anybody who is focusing on Iran today. So with that being said, please welcome my guest, Arash Azizi. How's it going?
Thank you very much, Sina. How are you? Thank you very much for your kind words. I hope I deserve them. I'm very glad to be with you.
Of course. I want to start off with a very simple question, which is, why Soleimani? Why focus on his biography and sort of the telling of Iran's history? There's so many huge personalities, right? There's Khomeini, there's, you know, Javad Zarif, and all these sort of huge personalities. Why focus on Qasem Soleimani?
Soleimani has always been fascinating to me because he was able to really move seamlessly across national borders and build a sort of transnational army. That's actually a pretty rare thing in history, right? One of the basic conditions of national states is that we all in some capacity kind of declare a willingness to die for our nation, right? It's part of, I mean, if you're from Iran, obviously you have to serve in the national army for 2 years, but everywhere in the world, even the countries that don't have conscription, you know, when there are wars, you go and join up your national army, right? When you're exempt, your exemption is only for the peacetime. So, but it's a much less common thing for people to sign up in an army headed by people of another nation to go and die in some other third country. And yet that's exactly what thousands of men did for Qasem Soleimani and under his command. So he was interesting to me because I'm long interested in the question of Iran and the world, if I put it very broadly, like how does Iran connect with the world? And more narrowly, Iran and the Arab world. And there's almost a, you know, there's, for me, there's almost a kind of a sad story here. And is that I've always lamented that why is it that the artists, the people that I like myself and sort of the progressive left, we have very few links in the region. You know, an Iranian, an Iranian who reads books is much more likely to read books in French, Germany, Spain, Latin America, Chile, you know, which are like tons of kilometers away, than say Iraq, a country with which we have many links and it's right next door. Whereas for the regime in Iran and for all these groups that I, you know, from the outset say I sort of view negatively, they have many links and they have very impressive links, in fact, that in these years, Iran and Iraq have become really integrated through these links. So Soleimani for me is interesting as a case of internationalism, as someone who embodied really an internationalism that I discuss in the book in sort of a historical overview and that really came to serious heights in the last few years. And I, you know, I was writing the book, by the way, before he got killed. Him getting killed just expedited the process, basically, because the publisher told me, you know, it's now or never, you know, you need to have a book out on him. But also, you know, increase the interest in him, I guess, which hasn't been met with the book. But yes, I think it is this journey of looking for links between Iran and the world and this question of internationalism that made Soleimani a good candidate through whom I could tell everybody about its history the last 40 years.
That's interesting to me, because you touched on this idea of transnationalism, and in the study of Iran, that idea of transnationalism is always casted within Shiism. It's always casted within a sort of religious idea, whether it's the revolutionary Shiism of Khomeini or this idea that Iran has always played a connection within broader Shia politics. But as a historian, when you were telling Soleimani's story, did that change your view of Iran's history and Iran's connection within the broader world? Did you have to go revisit some ideas and say, well, that's also like a valid thesis or idea, or did it not really change anything for you?
That's an excellent question, and let me please get at it from a couple of perspectives. First of all, it is true that Shiism is exceptionally transnational, in a way that it's, dare I say, rare in the modern world, in fact. I mean, the examples are a lot. In my book, for example, I discuss Musa al-Sadr, known as the sort of banished imam. And here's basically an Iranian cleric who later in life, he's like in his 40s or 50s, when he goes to Lebanon and reinvents himself in Lebanon as a religious political leader, and he's to this day is known as the leader of the Lebanese Shia. He becomes a very important political personality on a world scale. He meets the Pope, he meets all sorts of characters, and in Lebanon, he becomes a very important character. Now, this is a pretty rare thing, right? For someone to be from a country, grow up in that country, until a very late age, as I said, and then reinvent himself in another country, and just so easily. And Shiism and the kind of links that it has, especially between the Shia communities of mostly Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon, but also Afghanistan, and India, and Pakistan, and other parts of the world, is unique. And I discuss a few other transplantations like this. Mehdi Chambran, again, is an Iranian who goes and reinvents himself and, also marries a Lebanese person and becomes really an important part of Lebanon's political culture. And we have all sorts of, people in Iraq and Iran who are. So Shiism does have kind of a unique transnational possibility, if you will, especially on this sort of clerical level. And the clerics are really sort of a transnational corpus, like that if you, today Ayatollah Sistani is a national leader in Iraq, right? He's the most revered religious figure in the country. Sistan, as we know, is in Iran, so he has Iranian origins. So this puzzles the observers sometimes. They're like, well, is he sort of an Iraqi nationalist? Can he be? Is his Iranian origin? And I would say that in the world of Shia clerics, of course, nationality is something that is not that they simply reject it, but it certainly is a conundrum, if you will. It's not actually rejected, because after all these people had to work in a national framework, which they don't reject, including Khomeini, Sistani, and others, and that, and they have to contend with in different ways. So that's just a general sort of point about Shiism. But the other point I want to say really relates to the second part of your question about, what's the new thing that I found. The thing is, the Shia transnational connections are just a potential, right? They're a potential. And of course, all world religions are transnational. So I did say that, Shiism is kind of unique in this way, because it has, in this day and age, it has a sort of high transnational capabilities, if you will. But all, the Catholic Church is obviously a transnational organization. The Pope appoints cardinals everywhere, which is why, in the United States, of course, when you first had a Catholic president, John F. Kennedy, the fear-mongering right would say that, is he going to be controlled by the Pope? Speaking to some anxiety between transnational religious institutions and national institutions that are supposed to be, the primary depository of one's loyalty. So my point is that this religious transnational creates a potential, but they're not the last word on the subject. And so you cannot understand, where am I going with this, is you cannot understand the civil wars in the region. You cannot understand how could Qasem Soleimani recruit so many people by just the fact that they were Shia. In fact, if it was so easy, then why do you, you know, why do you need a capable commander like Soleimani? If the Shias would just so naturally go join up. And if they so naturally would join up, why is it that they, in the Iran-Iraq war, after all, the Iraqi Shia, by and large, fought for their country, Iraq. They did not join the Shia majority country, that is Iran. So basically, the points that I'm trying to give, and it's not a very straightforward point always, but it's that the transnational connections are a potential, are one factor in a situation, and they're not the last word. And that for the most people, for most actors, is not a basic choice between sort of religious identity and nationality, but a more layered question that, and that depends on the context in each specific case. And I have struggled to understand the evolution of internationalism in Islamic Republic of, you know, from the moment of the revolution, 79, I mean, from before the revolution actually, and the moment of the revolution and to today. What is it, how is it that this internationalism changes? And I think if this book might offer something that might be you know, of interest, especially to the scholars of the field, I would humbly suggest that this is it, that I give clues via this biography as to the evolution of the of this internationalism. And here is where, you know, being a historian is useful or potentially fascinating, because it's all in the specifics. You might have, I think this is a fascinating point, right? We all have general views of something. And sometimes you really spend hours in the library and study the detail, and you're basically say, you know, that general suspicion or view is confirmed. You're like, okay, so that's what it is. But often that's not the case. And that's the story of Iranian internationalism for me that I've grappled with, and that Iran really is a conundrum, because there are not easy answers to this question. You know, how Shia sectarianism matters or doesn't matter in what year, and you know, what actors use sectarianism and to what purpose. And I would say that they're not really straightforward answers. And I'm not someone who actually loves to give non-straightforward answers. You know, it's, I think, when you can, it is. After all, our job is to study these things and make them more understandable, really, not the other way around, as sometimes it seems to be the trend. But that, in, you know, genuinely, there is no easy answer to the question of, you know, is Iran using Shia sectarianism or not? Is it, you know, is it a Shia sectarian force or not? And how to balance it with different priorities and political goals that not just Iranian state, but all these different actors that are mobilized by Soleimani in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Yemen, and other countries. You know, there is no easy way to explain that. And I would say that I was surprised many times and, you know, really thought hard and long before putting things on paper about each and every one of them, and try to make conclusions that I can defend and that they're not boring and, you know, somewhat sweeping when possible, but also that they're not just sort of empty, you know, claims, and that they're backed by something.
Awesome. So what really caught me off guard about this book was Soleimani's early life, because his later life is you know, incredibly fleshed out. Like, you, when he, you know, stops being a commander and starts being a myth or a meme, you know, there's a lot of that part of his life, the towards the end of his life. But his early life just caught me, just like kind of blew my mind. Like, he is this young man in his 20s in Kerman, in this kind of poor area of Iran. And, you know, describe his life, you know, before and during the revolution. Is he this ideological guy who's going out and protesting? Is he just like, you know, I'm just going to work and not really care about this revolution? What, you know, who is he at, you know, in 1979, 1980, during this period of the revolution?
Well, as you know, he was whatever he was. He certainly wasn't a sort of young ideological person, as I try to show in the book. So Qasem Soleimani was born in Qanat Mulk, a little village in south of Iran. It's a village that it's more than 200 kilometers away, even from the center of the province, Kerman. And it's a village like of which, you know, exists anywhere in the world, in which the origins of the village goes back to tribes that were settled, forcibly settled, right? So national state, in this case, under Reza Shah, the founder of the Pahlavi monarchy, forced them to settle. There are many such villages in the world. I remember being in one in Jordan, you know, those who visit Petra, usually that's what has happened to many of the tribes, you know, in Jordan, near Petra, because they're sort of settled in villages and their life now revolves around the tourism industry and the ancient ruins of Petra. So this is also, Qanat Mulk is also one such place. So Soleimani is from there, and, you know, he's from a very modest background. And, you know, in the book I explain, wouldn't go into it all now here, but now I explain how basically the, let's just say, in complete success or failure, according to how you see it, of the land reform by the Shah, by the Shah of Iran, the monarch of Iran, explains how his family is indebted, and, you know, young people like Soleimani need to go and work jobs in construction and sort of that sort of jobs to pay for the family. But more important than that, like any other young person from a small place, like a really small place of, I think he has 300 families or something, you know, Soleimani wants to go and see the world. And he does. So he goes to Kerman, the provincial center, which is still a kind of a small town in Iran by Iranian standards, right? It's not, it's my maternal hometown, so I got to be careful sort of what I say about it. But, you know, it's not really one of the top five of Iran, let's say, even. But still, it's a much bigger world than was, you know, what Soleimani was used to. And there in Kerman, he works at a hotel. He works as a civil servant in the water organization. And he also, you know, he takes a lot of members of his family, his brother, his cousins, you know, they sort of all live in these rented rooms and, you know, leaving Kerman and experience this big city with all the changes, with people who are now reading all sorts of sort of books, a lot of left-wing books, people who are involved in the revolutionary movement. And yeah, he does go to a mosque a couple of times, including when a revolutionary cleric, which is some kamyab, visits and gives the sermon. Soleimani is there, but by and large, he's not he's not religious. He's certainly not really political. He's a young man in his early 20s who is interested in the world and who's interested in broadening his horizons, broadly speaking, right? But the most important thing that happens to him in these years is that he joins the karate club and the boxing club. And, you know, he's very much a gym guy. He spends a lot of his time in gym and he's very physically impressive. And karate and boxing are especially sort of important in this regard because they give you sort of a discipline and they give you, you know, they give you a bigger world, right? If you come from a small place. And after the revolution, Soleimani first signs up to join the IRGC, this militia that had been formed to defend the gains of the Iranian revolution and defeat its sort of internal and external enemies. And he got rejected because he just doesn't look like a, you know, good, nice Islamist boy. He has a short sleeve shirt and he has funny hair. And we know all of this because the guy who rejected him, of course, would be taunted by him for years in sort of a comical way that, or, you know, remember when you said I wasn't good enough to join the IRGC? So that's really the story. But at some point they get him. He's able to join a sort of a reserve force. And that's, of course, when the war between Iran and Iraq starts in 1980. And Soleimani signs up to go to the war and fight, like, again, what any young man would do if they want to broaden their horizons. And that certainly is what happens. He goes to the war, and this is where he can prove sort of his, can prove he's a good soldier. And he joined the IRGC's in about 1980, and he joins the war effort there. And to the very last day in his life, unlike many of his comrades, he never took the khakis off, and he remains a IRGC soldier to the very end of his life, from his early 20s. So really, this, what what I think the story of early years that I focused perhaps a little, I spent quite a bit on it. And as you know, because I just wanted to give a background of how is it that, a Iranian like myself of my parents' generation would choose the path that he did. And I think this is a story of people from marginal backgrounds joining up a revolution after the revolution had been already made. And this is important because they're not those who make the revolution by and large. The revolution is made by the people from the center, mostly. But after the revolution, they're mobilized by this new republic, new regime. And that gives them a new life and a new meaning in the battlefields of a long 8 years war with Iraq and everything that comes after. I think that's an important perspective on understanding the regime in Iran that is sometimes not thought about.
So he comes out of Iraq, and the Iraq war ends in 1988, 1989. Please correct me if I'm wrong. And
88.
And so this is the, from out of the revolution comes the 90s. And this is kind of before 9/11 and before the war in Iraq, the 2003 war in Iraq. I have to be more specific. What does he do in the 90s? What is his position? What is his sort of focus in that sort of period from the end of the Iraq war to the beginning of the 2003 war?
Mm-hmm. So the war, of course, goes on for 8 long years because Iran, being a revolutionary regime, tries to do what all revolutionary regimes have done. But if the Napoleonic army was actually able to conquer much of Europe, and if the Red Army was, after the Russian Revolution, able to conquer much of at least the Russian Empire and, tried getting to Warsaw and was defeated in the Vistula, the Iranian, the Islamic Republic also, thought that they could, to quote an expression that became very popular at the time, they could make Karbala a bridge to Jerusalem. So the idea was that we'll, of course, overthrow Saddam Hussein in Iraq and we'll go on to conquer and, sort of spread the message of our revolution around the world. That doesn't quite work out. Not only they can't get to Karbala, they can, if you talk to a lot of old Iranian fighters, the frustration that they could never even conquer Basra, a Shia majority city port in the south of Iraq, whose lights you can see. I mean, and I've been there, on the Iranian side, you can see the lights of Basra from Iranian territory, but they're not even able to conquer that after 8 years of a bloody war, after having kicked out Saddam's forces much earlier in the war. So the end of the war is with a compromise. They have to give up basically Ayatollah Khomeini, who until the very end had said that he would not accept a peace. He does it. He says doing so, it's like drinking a chalice of poison, which is the name of a chapter of the book that I wrote about this. Khomeini also dies shortly after drinking this chalice of poison and accepting the UN resolution that ends the war. So people like Soleimani and them start becoming kind of a frustrated group of people who thought they had been betrayed by diplomats and politicians. Incidentally, Javad Zarif was a young diplomat at the Iran's permanent representation in the United Nations in New York at the time, and center of a group called New York Boys. And he becomes a lot of people don't like him because of this. And they, even then, the Iranian sort of conservatives attack him. So he's been used to this all his life, basically. Soleimani is also one of those frustrated soldiers who are not happy with this peace, basically, with this end of the war without getting the results that they had wanted. But unlike many of them, he remains in the military. A lot of them go to do different things. After the end of the war and the death of Khomeini and also the fall of the Berlin Wall, really, Iran is also caught up in that ideological shift, if you will. It becomes a much more capitalist country. And the debate over is Islamic Republic socialist or capitalist or, what it is, basically is resolved in favor of private property and capitalism in the late 80s. So a lot of these ex-soldiers get into business or they join the construction efforts under President Rafsanjani. But Soleimani keeps on his uniform and he remains in the force. Now, what he does is interesting. He becomes basically in charge of battling drug gangs, which roamed free across much of Iran, specifically the eastern borderlands, i.e. where Iran meets Afghanistan and Pakistan, an area that is, to a large part on the Iranian side and on the other sides, let's say ungoverned by the national states, or where national states have difficulty governing it. Here is where there are local guerrillas, there are drug gangs, there are all sorts of forces. And Soleimani becomes in charge of this. And by all accounts, he does a pretty good job of fighting the drug gangs, of opening roads, of making the area more accessible. And that's his big post-war assignment, in which he excels. And also because of this, he becomes part of IRGC's and Iran's Afghanistan hands, let's say, i.e. people in the foreign policy establishment and military establishment of Iran who are in charge of dealing with Afghanistan, who, as you know, was seeing important changes there. The Soviet invasion fails in the 80s. It is followed by rise of an Islamic government in Afghanistan that Iran supports, but then this government is overthrown by Taliban, the force that I imagine most of your audience know well. And Soleimani is an important, when Kabul is falling to Taliban, Soleimani is not far actually, and he gives hope to the leadership of the Afghan government, and he helps takes them somewhere else, and he helps organize the resistance from Tajikistan. So as part of his job in fighting the drug lords in eastern Iran, he also becomes a liaison of Iran with Afghanistan, which leads to the last appointment of his life and the most important one. And in 1998, he's appointed the head of the Quds Force. The Quds Force had been founded in late 80s, and it's basically tasked with organizing and giving some order to the previously haphazard external operations of the IRGC, i.e. Establishing links, organizing the links with Hezbollah, the militia that exists in Lebanon, and other forces that had ties with the IRGC or were IRGC allies. And this is the assignment in which Soleimani rises to become one of the world's best known military generals. And to the last day of his life, he was the commander of the Quds Force, to which he had been appointed in early 1998. And since you mentioned up to the Iraq War, so of course between 1998 and 2003, we have the 9/11 and the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. It is well known that Iran collaborated with the United States in fighting Taliban, and Soleimani was basically the head of this collaboration with the United States. To quote an Iranian diplomat that I mentioned in the book, Iran and the United States have an unwritten pact that they're allies in the fight against Taliban. It's interesting in light of what we've heard recently about Iran and Al-Qaeda ties. I go into the book the couple of times in which Soleimani rejects a offer from Al-Qaeda leadership to join up with them and fight against to fight against the Americans. It's more nuanced. There are the Iran Al-Qaeda relationship. I'm sure you have others also speak on it, and I've mentioned the book. Different instances. It does happen at some places in Bosnia, for example, in the early 90s. But at any rate, in 2001, this is an important part of Soleimani is in charge of negotiating with some of the Americans and helping them, being basically the ground force that Americans can rely on as they attack Taliban. I think that's also a very important part of Soleimani's life. The 2003 invasion of Iraq is followed, of course, by George W. Bush. Before George W. Bush invades Iraq, he declares Iran, along with Iraq, to be part of an axis of evil, which is what sort of puts a damper or puts an end to the Iran-American collaboration against Taliban. And the war against Iraq comes to really define Soleimani's life and the subsequent history of the Islamic Republic. It is at the beginning of the U.S. invasion, Iran is very afraid of what's going to happen to it, and it's prepared to even work more with Americans. But then, you know, in order to basically, you know, from a position of weakness, frankly. But when that doesn't materialize, it starts the slow burn building of its forces in Iraq and in the region. And I could say that without the U.S. invasion of Iraq, it's hard to see how Iran could have rose to the sort of power that it builds in the region in the 2 decades that follow the invasion.
So before we hop into post 2003, when I was reading your book, it was very, like, two sets of details very stood out in my mind. One was Soleimani's participation in Iraq, in the Iran-Iraq war, and then his participation in sort of these operations on the eastern border of Iran, dealing with Afghanistan and Pakistan and the drug lords. And it just struck me that it almost seemed like his engagement and sort of countering these drug lords was much more formative in his approach to problem solving going forward than the Iran-Iraq war. So
that's that. I love the way you put that. Yeah. So may I? Or
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So. I love the way that you put that. I hadn't heard anyone putting it like that, but there's a lot of truth to what you say. In fact, when you look at his account, I mean, Iran-Iraq war is obviously important. It's where Iran forms the sort of ideology of, a ideology of a struggle that it kind of lacks before. I mean, this is an important part of this story, is that the Iranian Islamists really always have a chip on their shoulder next to, say, Marxists, who are, you know, Marxists know their books, they know their theory, they have their international allies, they're much more serious than Islamists who don't really, they're very new to this game. And, they don't always have really established brand of ideology and theory and all that. And in the Iran-Iraq war, they build at least an operational version of that, right? Of an ethos, if you will. So Iran-Iraq war is obviously important, but Soleimani doesn't seem to have been that. I mean, he's impressive enough in the war. He's one of the mid-level commanders. He basically built a division out of kids from Kerman province and its two adjacent provinces in southeastern Iran. So, but you know, he doesn't seem to have been that operationally impressive or nothing out of the ordinary. But, you know, as he is later in life. So where does he build up the experience that helps him in later in life to deal with this irregular warfare, right? Being able to, because it's something to fight in a classical war as part of a national army, it's something entirely else to manage different guerrillas, to, you know, take Afghan militias, train them in Iran, take them to Syria to fight together with the Lebanese against, a transnational force like ISIS, right? This really requires a different sort of set of skills. And I think you're right that it is in the war, in the drug wars, and in the Eastern Borderlands war, that he learns a lot of those skills, because there he has to, you know, I have instances of him where he effectively unwittingly becomes a diplomat, because he has to negotiate with an Afghan village on Afghan border village about them surrendering some of the people they have. He has to deal with the Baluchistan area, which is a transnational area in Iran and Pakistan. There are two big provinces called Baluchistan, and the Baluchi people there have a very proud history and they have links. So he has to learn how to operate in that sort of atmosphere. And, the Afghan civil war, which is spilling into Iran in some ways. I explain how some of the outlaws and drug lords operating in Iran were linked to Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, a warlord in Afghanistan. So, and in fact, it is this experience that leads to him becoming involved in foreign affairs, right? First, because he becomes one of the Afghanistan hands, as I said, in sort of an unofficial fashion. And second, when in 1998, Ayatollah Khamenei, Supreme Leader of Iran, appoints him the head of the Quds Force. So you're very much correct to say, while the experience of the Iran-Iraq War was obviously important in several ways, it is really those experiences of, let's just call it, irregular war in Eastern borders that leads to his appointment to the head of the Quds Force, and that proves essential to his 22 years as the head of this force.
So to leap forward back in time, back to 2003. So the Iraq War kicks off, the United States invades Iraq, things shortly begin to fall apart. Where is Soleimani in all this? You made a point, and I kind of want you to elaborate on it, is that they were kind of in a position of, you know, working with the United States until the famous or infamous Axis of Evil speech. But where is Soleimani? What is he doing in 2003 in regards to the invasion of Iraq?
So the invasion of Iraq presents Iran with an opportunity because Saddam Hussein is gone. And, you know, Iraq is now a more open field. So Soleimani, from the early on, let me start with, so he sends people in, right? He sends people, organizes people in, and it soon becomes clear that the Iranian embassy in the new Iraq is going to be not led by the foreign ministry, but by the Quds Force. This remains a fact to this day. To this day, Javad Zarif does not control what the Iranian embassy in Iraq does, nor does President Rouhani, the head of the Quds Force, does. That was certainly the case under Qasem Soleimani. It's been a year since he's gone. I imagine that is pretty much the same under his successor, Ismail Khamenei. So he sends people in, and he sends people in different guises. One of the most interesting ones is that he sends people in to take care of the shrines. There are Shia shrines in Iraq, and Iran, as the major Shia country in the world, of course, has some claim into, you know, we're there to restore the tiles and build these buildings and take care of them. Of course, this an organization that sounds very benign that is in charge of basically taking care of these Shia shrines. It sounds like a sort of a, you know, sort of a restoration architecture of organization, right? But it becomes actually a vast military operation in which IRGC uses it as a cover to really increase its influence in Iraq, all over Iraq. There are Shia shrines in Baghdad, in Samarra, in Karbala, and smaller ones in some other places. And Soleimani builds up a presence of Iran in Iraq in those years, and it helps the resistance. Basically, it helps the groups that were fighting the American invasion. And that's, you know, these are some of the Sunni forces. They're different forces. They're sort of Saddamist forces, let's call them. The Naqshbandi army is a name that comes to form. So Soleimani doesn't necessarily help this particular group, but he kills a lot of Americans, to put it clearly. This is important because, of course, this is a thing that is missed sometimes because, if you say a version of history in which, well, Soleimani was helping Americans here and also against ISIS later on in Iraq. You know, so why is it that so many in the American sort of military establishment hate him? Well, they don't forget this early part, that he makes their life hell. He's the one who builds those IEDs and different sort of bombs that makes the life of American soldiers hell in a lot of places, and of course increases Iran's influence to the degree that it soon becomes very clear what has been the fact in Iraqi history since the invasion till 2020, in the early 2020, where Soleimani is killed. In these years, it becomes very clear that Iran, effectively, together with the United States, is one who decides who's going to be the prime minister of Iraq. This has been the fact. There are elections, but really, who gets to form a government in Iraq would not happen without the consent of Tehran and Washington. I believe Mustafa Kazemi, the current prime minister of Iraq, is the first one who break with this trend, and very much his political career is about asserting the sovereignty of Iraq against both Iran and the United States, in a sense. with Iran being the more powerful sort of a state in Iraq now, so it's sort of more relevant. So the short answer is Soleimani is able to use the opening caused by the fall of Saddam to expand Iranian influence and build very serious Iranian military influence. And this is no easy task. And in the book, I explain some of the pitfalls and some of the problems and some of the ways in which he does it, because the Iraqi Shia political groups can't agree with him themselves. And also, you know, they've throughout the long years of Saddam Hussein, they've spent their life either studying in some religious seminary in Iran or, you know, owning a pizza shop in Dearborn, Michigan. So they're not exactly fit for work of politics, you know, in a new country. And Soleimani is able to butt some heads together, put some groups together, and really expand Iran's influence. And by no way this is an easy task or something that we can just assume happened. So really, that is the chronicle. This is the crown, if you will, the jewel crown in his empire. It's like it's Iraq. It's really where he shows his most talent, if you will. But of course, it's also where, toward the end of his life, he had to face the rising movement of Iraqi people, who of course didn't want their fate to be decided by a military general from another country. And had Soleimani not been killed by Trump, I think he would have had to seen his most prized force in Iraq also really unravel, not by Americans, but by the wrath of the Iraqi people, including Iraqi Shia, who were not happy with the heavy-handed way in which he had expanded Iran's influence in their country.
That's an interesting point, because it seems like the strategy that Soleimani uses in Iraq was so explicitly hinged on sectarianism and even extreme sectarianism, in the sense that you pointed out that, you know, their first move in Iraq was to protect the shrines. So obviously they're protecting the shrines in an environment where you also have Al-Qaeda in Iraq and, you know, with their explicitly sort of sectarian strategy. But going back to Soleimani, it seems like, you know, his sort of center stone, his sort of capstone in his Iraq strategy was explicit sectarianism. You know, it wasn't about Iraqi nationalism. It's about Shia or Iraqi Shia or Shias in Iraq that, you know, believe in, you know, Iran as a benefactor, supporter, protector, whatever. But is that accurate, or is there more sort of, you know, a more secular sort of understanding or approach to, you know, Iraq from, you know, Soleimani's perspective?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And, you know, early on, I was trying to explain something about sectarianism, and that's sort of what I was getting at. So I'm very glad you brought it up in this regard. So what happens, let me just, that I don't believe the Iranian state has sectarianism sort of built into it, because it has bigger ambitions than being a defender of the Shia only, really. It wants to be the leader of the Islamic world. Hell, it wants to be the leader of the world's oppressed from the beginning, right? So it has bigger ambitions. So why is it that it comes to employ what you correctly call sort of extreme sectarianism? And Soleimani certainly has become a sectarian figure. It's because they discover very soon that this sectarianism in an environment that was already sectarianized, there's a great book called Sectarianization, and even the title, sort of explains that it's not that sectarian identities are just there forever, but that we have sectarianization. So in an environment where sectarianization is happening, and I'll explain what I mean about that in a second, The Iranians understand very quickly that this is a great way to have people sign up in your armies and get killed. After all, what did they have before? They had sort of a stale anti-Zionism, revolutionary Islamism that really is not that convincing, right? It's about this. So how do you sign up people? It's a political question. How do you sign up people to join up and fight for you politically and militarily? So it's not, as I said, it's not what I call the stale Islamism that had sort of gone out of energy by early 2000s, but Shia identity. It can be a great one, especially because, of course, a lot of Shia are under attack by Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the Jordanian who heads the Al-Qaeda organization in Iraq, really it becomes a, you know, starts adopting methods that makes the leadership like Osama bin Laden and them recoil. And that's how violent he is. And really, so that's how sectarianization on both sides. So Iran pushes it and the Sunni sides push it, like Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And of course, later on, we have ISIS. And there are different events. In 2005, we have the killing of Rafiq Hariri, a Sunni prime minister of Lebanon. The very overthrow of Saddam and his execution, he was seen as a leader in the Sunni world. Or what is sort of, not only he was a leader in the Sunni world, but his death really forms the Sunni world. You know, there's sort of a symbiotic relationship here. So in this atmosphere, they learn that sectarianism is very good, and it's very good for them. It's a pretty easy way to organize people compared to sort of political mumbo jumbo of the previous years, and they use it. So in short, this is a story of a very cynical utilization of sectarianism to advance their thought. In the same way that I think, I'm not sure Donald Trump himself, but certainly many right-wing Republicans or right-wing political figures around the world don't necessarily believe in the racism or white nationalism or the stuff that, or anti-Semitism that they use. They very cynically use it as a way to manipulate people, as a way to rile up their audiences. Sometimes they believe it, sometimes they use it cynically. And I believe in the case of Iran, is a lot of that. Is a lot of that cynical use of sectarianism. And it's a very unfortunate fact that creates sectarian enmity and hatred and tension in the region, and has to this day. But it wasn't preordained for this to happen. And it certainly, in the last 20 years, it has happened. This is, I need to emphasize this because it's very sad, frankly. It's very sad that published authors, serious people, and all sorts of people would, talk about how, of course, you can explain the problems in the Middle East because the Shia and Sunni have been fighting each other for 1,000 years. Frankly, it's embarrassingly stupid, to say something like that when you have very serious people, working on sectarianism in all sorts of ways. And write books about it. And one wonders, what do all these people do at these government-funded departments if you're just going to sort of repeat cliches that, probably someone's uncle would say. So, I think, basically that's when you look at how sectarianization happens and how sectarianities are sometimes prioritized and sometimes not, and used by politicians sometimes and sometimes not, you avoid falling into the cliches like the ones I mentioned.
So I want to maybe touch on something that you touched on, but I want you to elaborate a bit on it, which is the tension between the foreign ministry, the Quds Force, and then MOIS. So that's Iran's intelligence services, because there's just like what really stood out for me in the book is that you kind of highlight this tension between Javad Zarif, he's very stereotypically, he's very educated, went to, I think, Yale, Stanford, Harvard, one of them.
Neither, but I think he didn't go to Ivy League. I think it was the University of Southern California. I actually think he went to Denver, I think, actually. If I'm not mistaken, he went to the University of Denver. I'm not sure, but is that where Condoleezza Rice went? Anyways.
I have no idea.
Yeah, I think he went to Denver. So,
you highlight the tension between what I consider Javad Zarif and the foreign ministry and traditional diplomacy with the diplomacy, if that's an accurate way to describe it, of the Quds Force, of Soleimani sort of going out and building relationships with, Hassan Nasrallah or the Iraqi government, or even sort of the most infamous example is that David Petraeus had, you know, Qasem Soleimani, it was rumored that he had him on speed dial. But sort of highlight that for us, because that was just an absolutely fascinating part of the book, was this tension between traditional diplomacy and then God's force diplomacy.
So first of all, I did check when you were asking, and yeah, he went to San Francisco State University and the University of Denver. He got his MA and PhD from University of Denver. So, you know, to all those in Denver, Javad Zarif is your, so he lived in Denver for a while. So maybe someone can write a book about the Denver roots of, you know, Iranian foreign policy. But back to your question. Asked earlier, you know, what is it that made me think twice revisited my assumptions? I mean, this is a very complex relationship that is hard to understand. Soleimani and Zarif, right? In fact, that could have been a book sort of about the tensions between Soleimani and Zarif, or how to see the Iranian history of the last 20 years as between these two men who are both, they have something in common. They're good, loyal soldiers of Ayatollah Khamenei. That's very clear. Khamenei personally trusts them. They sort of go back to him personally. And so how could they be on opposing sides? In fact, Zarif recently gave an interview in which they sort of ask him about this TV series in Iran, which is funded by the IRGC, and paints him as a traitor, as a, you know, sort of a traitor who sits down with Americans, which is how they portrayed him. And as I said, even back to the 1988, end of the Iraq War, they portrayed him and other diplomats like that. And Zarif sort of had to speak about this conundrum that, as part of foreign ministry, he has to defend all institutions of the country, including the IRGC abroad, whereas the IRGC itself attacks him so virulently. So what do we have really here? So here's what I think. I think, number one, Iran is both a regime and a revolution, right? It's both both a country and a revolution. I say this to sort of as a retort to Henry Kissinger, which sort of had famously said in the last few years that Iran has to choose between being a country and a revolution. It has never ceased to be either since the revolution of 1979. Iran both is a national state with capabilities and sort of usual things that national states do, including diplomacy and diplomatic relations with different countries in the world, and a revolutionary regime that has revolutionary institutions led by the supreme leader, whose supreme leader is sort of a made up English title, by the way. His real title is leader of the revolution in Iran. So there are these revolutionary institutions, and there is the national state. And the supreme leader controls much of the national state, and he controls all of the revolutionary institutions. So they sometimes do come into conflict. They sometimes do come into conflict, especially because the limited caste of rulers in the Islamic Republic, the governing caste, has had many splits between itself. On the extreme left, if you will, there are people who are liberal democrats who want Iran to be a liberal democratic country. And then on the extreme right are Khamenei and them. And there are many things in between, like someone like President Rouhani wants Iran to be sort of a technocratic state. So as a result, you have these conflicts. Where does this end us? It ends us with saying that the IRGC and foreign ministry in the last 20 years have been both under the indirect control of Ayatollah Khamenei. Anyways, I mean, indirect in terms of the foreign ministry, more direct in terms of the IRGC. And he uses them in different ways. Ayatollah Khamenei has proven to be a very interesting sort of character, in a sense that he doesn't so easily back aside. He's a balancer. He's a manipulator of different factions of the regime. He knows that if he only backed one side sort of unreservedly, it would endanger the durability of the regime. Now, this, he has become more and more partisan and one-sided as time has gone on, which is why I believe, and many believe, the regime has paid the price and is more brittle and more in crisis now. But at the same time, Khamenei has never disavowed Javad Zarif and the Rouhani government. In fact, to the opposite, he's always supported them. So you have this conundrum, right? You have the situation in which the Iranian conservatives, dominant in the Iranian parliament, foam at their mouth attacking Zarif and attacking the Iran deal and the negotiations that led to it, right? The Iran deal of 2015. But really, they consider themselves, these people who really hate the Iran deal and hate the negotiations and hate Zarif, they consider themselves soldiers of Ayatollah Khamenei, who sort of loyal to Ayatollah Khamenei, who also supports Zarif both privately and publicly. So what's the conundrum? The conundrum is that, as I said, Khamenei is above them all, and you know, and they pursue different and sometimes contrasting goals. Them being the foreign ministry under the President Rouhani, and the IRGC, who acts as something like a big opposition party. I didn't mention the Ministry of Intelligence. The Ministry of Intelligence is a also nominally under President Rouhani and has its own long, it has its own sort of long history and institutional memory, if you will. Its job is mostly to fight domestic subversion, basically. Although when the Quds Force got formed in the late 80s, there was an agreement between the Quds Force and the Minister of Intelligence that Quds Force would take care of Iran's alliance with Hezbollah and its allied groups. Minister of Intelligence would focus on killing dissidents abroad. So the only thing Minister of Intelligence would do abroad is to kill dissidents, sometimes by using Hezbollah operatives. And I recently wrote a short article in New York Times about some of the history of this work and how, why it was stopped in the late 90s. So I won't so bore you with that here. But I hope I was able to explain the dichotomies between these three forces and different parts of the Iranian regime. And this is it's a really delicate question, because there are those out there who want to, let me just say the two false dichotomies. There are those out there who say, well, there is no such a thing as an Iranian moderate. You know, they're all the same. Well, they really are not all the same. They are not the same. They follow many different converging paths. And by they, I mean different factions in the Islamic Republic. But then there's also another side that portrays, that pretends like, President Rouhani is a Democrat, or is sort of, he really is like a sort of progressive person or something like that. And that's also not true. So I think what we need to do is understand different factions of the Iranian regime and their respective powers at different times. That's really the only way to do it. You don't have a simple, you don't have a simple answer of, oh, you know, they're all the same. There's no moderate between them, whatever moderate means, or the other way around. That, you know, to portray that, you know, Iran has no problem with the United States, and really, it's just a small number of hardliners who do. So I hope books like this and my general work and that of many others is able to educate people about the real existing differences within the Islamic Republic factions.
So, as you mentioned before, beginning in 2020, Qasem Soleimani is droned out of existence. He's killed. And so my first question in relation to his death is, what happened to the IRGC? Because at the same time that Soleimani is very charismatic, he kind of, a lot of authority runs through him, the IRGC is a bureaucracy in the way that I understand it. It's still an institution with its own paperwork, its own progression, whatever. But, you know, what has happened and what should we expect to happen with, you know, Soleimani being, you know, droned out of existence and all this?
The IRGC is a much bigger force, obviously, than one man. It controls something like half of the Iranian economy. I recently wrote an article for Iran Wire in which I explained, for example, how the IRGC and its rival institutions maintain control of Iran's startup, you know, tech startup industry, and some of the methods. So it's a massive organization, massive military and economic economic behemoth, really, that now is the main force in Iran, easily. And many expect them to win, for the winning candidate for the next Iranian presidential elections in June, although that, you know, that could change. But the question of Soleimani's demise and what it means. Well, before we get to IRGC as a whole, let's focus on the Quds Force, which is the external operations wing of the IRGC, which Soleimani headed. Look, yes, Quds Force is also a bureaucracy, but that's exactly the point. Soleimani is not a person that a bureaucracy can replicate, right? He's not just, he is simply irreplaceable. And I think a year after his assassination, I can say with some confidence that this is the conclusion that the IRGC leadership has come to itself. They basically decided, look, we can't replace Soleimani. So his successor, Ismail Ghani, let's just have more modest operations of him. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. Soleimani was someone who was able to seamlessly move across borders in this energetic, impressive way. He was in every battlefield, something that he had, you know, done throughout his life in the Iran-Iraq war and also the drug wars. He was the guy who would parachute into a Iraqi Shia Turkoman town when it was besieged by ISIS. And, you know, he would parachute in there and he would organize the people in the city to fight against ISIS. He was one who was not afraid to go to different parts of the Syrian civil war. They say he would have breakfast in Tehran, lunch in Baghdad, and dinner in Beirut, and, you know, maybe an aperitif in Damascus. Not sure he had aperitifs, but you know, you get the point. So this is not someone that you can easily replace, right? And Ismail Ghani is not that. He barely speaks Arabic. He's learned, I guess, in the last year. A bit more, but he didn't before. He didn't really speak Arabic before. He's certainly not charismatic, nothing like Soleimani's charisma. He doesn't have the personal relations that Soleimani had built over decades with the leadership of Shia forces in Iraq and Lebanon and other places. So he has proved his shoes are basically impossible to fill. And I think the IRGC leadership has decided that Ghani is going to be a more modest, more bureaucratic figure, something of a coordinator between the different Shia forces allied with Iran. And that's what they basically decided, that Soleimani can't be there. As for the IRGC as a whole, you know, that Soleimani had, I revealed in the book for the first time, that Soleimani had planned to run in presidential elections in 6 months. And him running would have been a sort of very different scenario, really. It's fascinating to think what would have happened had Soleimani remained alive and had he been able to run in the elections. It would have been a very different event than anyone alive in the IRGC, since Soleimani was very unique. He was seen as much more of a, I mean, I don't believe that most Iranians like him, unlike what some analysts say. I don't have sort of magic polling to know, but I do believe that he definitely was seen as a national figure by more, you know, compared to any other figure in the IRGC. So his demise has important political consequences that as well. And God knows, you know, had he remained and had he run in the elections, as he certainly was thinking about, God knows what would be the ramifications. If I was Khamenei, I would be very afraid of that, of course, right? You have a military charismatic guy who is also the president. I don't think the Supreme Leader would have had the same power had that happened, even though Soleimani was a devoted and beloved sort of soldier of Khamenei, who by all indications really loved him personally and served him all his life.
That's interesting, because you point out that Ismail Ghani, the guy who's coming in to replace Soleimani, is more of a coordinator. So in that sense, the last 10 years of Quds Force activity, do we characterize that as output that's related to sort of Soleimani as a commander and sort of doing his best and being the most aggressive within whatever bounds is set by Khamenei? Or is it simply that whoever comes next will have the same level of involvement and aggression? Like, I guess what I'm asking is
all about Soleimani. Sorry, go on, yeah.
I guess what I'm asking is how much is his charisma and his own leadership versus the underlying bureaucracy and institution of the Quds Force that is leading the Quds Force to be sort of so heavily involved in everything in sort of the, you know, Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen, et cetera?
So obviously, you know, if you want to do the job of Soleimani, you need to have the support of national resources of a country. And not only Soleimani had the support of a biggest state like Iran, he was able to use his celebrity effectively and his different links to do crazy things that won't be possible in normal times. What, for example, he was able to get, you know, I'll just give you a couple of examples. Paris Fattah, who's the head of the Mostazafan Foundation. This is a foundation that has billions of dollars of investments in Iran. It runs a hotel in Dubai, it runs mobile companies, it runs hotel chains all over Iran. So this foundation has access to all this money. The head, Paris Fattah, had a personal relationship with Soleimani. And Fattah gave an interview after Soleimani's demise and spoke of how Soleimani once came to him and just got millions of dollars from him to go pay his Afghan fighters that he didn't have the money for, apparently. So this is just one example of the kind of resources that Soleimani could use. The Hamas leadership recently spoke about how in one trip to Iran, they meet Ahmadinejad, who was president at the time, but really the most important meeting is with Soleimani, who sends them home with millions of dollars again. And he was even happy to give them more, but they didn't have enough suitcases, basically, enough people, basically, to be able to carry the suitcases. So that's, this sort of story shows what kind of a, you know, what kind of a figure Soleimani was. So obviously the resources matter, the institutions matter. He was built in the IRGC from, he had spent since he was 23, 24 years old. He had built up in this institution and had been built up in this institution. So obviously they matter, but it was a, as I said, it is Soleimani, this is Quds Force was Soleimani's project, and he really did it in a way that no one else could, frankly. This is no job description, right? It's something to say, after all, we have the Quds Force before Soleimani. We have about 10 years of Quds Force before Soleimani, and you have nothing like this, right? You have a couple of really bad failures, like in Bosnia, which I talk about in the book briefly. Iran tries to intervene in the Bosnian civil war. This is where Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda and Iran kind of work together a little bit in the context of the Bosnian civil war, the Yugoslav civil war. And it doesn't go very well. And it's a very difficult thing to do, frankly. Not only doesn't go very well, Iran has nothing to show for it at the end. Does a pro-Iranian political party exist in Bosnia? No, it doesn't. You know, despite millions of dollars that they spent. So what I'm trying to say is that, yes, Soleimani, personally, his charisma, his military acumen, the personal links that he built with Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, Imad Mughniyeh, one of the slain sort of leaders of Hezbollah, the relationship that he was able to build with Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, which convinces Putin that if he intervenes in the Syrian civil war, he has someone like Soleimani on the ground. These are very critical. This is not a task that anyone who wasn't in that position could have filled. Soleimani very much built up the story of Iran in the last 20 years is the story of Soleimani doing something very beyond what a basic sort of portfolio of a task would have had him do. And there's a relationship between military leadership and a political leadership, because Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, it set the tone, set the policies, Soleimani followed them. But Ayatollah Khamenei also knew that he has someone like Soleimani he can trust, that he, when you know you have that kind of tools, you decide to do more things, you know, compared to if you didn't have this. So that's, you know, that relationship is important.
So we've come to sort of the end of the conversation, and as per tradition, you know, the last question is always, you know, leave us, the audience, the interviewer, whomever, you know, with something to think about. I mean, we've only, like in our conversation, we've only touched on maybe, maybe half the book, maybe less than half the book. There's so much in this book that is fantastic. But definitely leave us something to think about, a takeaway, if you will, from the book, from, you know, your research.
I would say it's what I started talking about, really, to do a nice sort of circle back to that. I would say that we should be interested in this question of transnationalism and internationalism, and how is it that people from around the world would go and sign up to efforts beyond their nations? How is it that Afghan Shia youth volunteer? Think about it for a second, right? You're from a Afghan village, you volunteer, you get paid, of course, for it, but I mean, you get recruited to go fight under an Iranian in a war in Syria. Because now we have this in many different forms. The Syrian civil war, the Libyan civil war, they're all full of, and of course, ISIS in Iraq and in other parts in the limited way that it remains. These are all now full of national citizens of different countries that are either mercenaries or ideological recruits. So I would say that this is something to think about. How is it that these forces are built? And how is it that, you know, one could build, after all, in the 20th century, this was the prisoner of the left. It was the left that organized anti-fascist rallying in the world to go and fight in the Spanish Civil War. It was the left that organized the Communist International and built up communist parties in the world, you know, from, you know, all over the world, from the United States to Africa, to Iran, to China, everywhere. Communists under the same flag fought for what they thought was a common future for humanity. So I would say that it's interesting that in this age of globalization and, you know, all the talk of globalization, why is it that it is sometimes harder for progressives, apparently, to build transnational links where people on the other side of this political divide have done it so well. So I would think this is something in the Middle East we can think of. And I'll end with this dual answer, basically, that I think in the Middle East, we should have more of the transnational links on the progressive left, and for those fighting for democracy, we should, our answer to the shadow commanders should be, you know, alliances under light, if you will, and you know, transparent alliances. But also that as part of this, we have come to see that all these fantasies about the states in the Middle East being artificial and brittle and unreal, and we need to go beyond them. You know, I think we need to end these fantasies. And I'll point out to the movements of people in Iraq and Lebanon in 2019, two places that were victim to Soleimani's machinations more than anywhere else. Both of the movements continue in Iraq and in Lebanon against Iranian sort of imperial influence. And their approach is very much, we want a Lebanon, we want an Iraq that is sovereign and that works well, and that we want a state that is good, basically, that provides basic services. So I would say that we need internationalism, we need alliances across the borders, and we need to sort of study them, but also we need to take the framework of the national state seriously and put it as the base of our analysis and of our political organization, and end with the sort of fantasies of, you know, territorial fantasies of that pretends like these states are, you know, artificial or don't matter. So I think that's the dual message with which sort of I am, that, you know, we need good national states and national communities and taking it seriously, and transnational and international links that helps you pursue the goals that you want.
Awesome. So thank you so much for being on the show. That was That was Arash Azizi, the author of The Shadow Commander, Soleimani, the U.S. and Iran's Global Ambitions. Definitely, it is worth your time, and it's an excellent read. It's a detailed read, and we didn't even cover most of the book. We only touched on a couple topics. It's definitely worth reading. So again, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Of course.